My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest's childhood can be described as chaotic and extremely abusive. The effects of his early life caught up to him, and after he left the army, he broke down and planned his own suicide. He is now a trained psychiatric nurse and is currently researching mental health of military children for his PhD. Episode 18, Paul Watson. This is Declassified. If I kind of just said, what was childhood to you? What was your feelings if I just say that childhood? What is it?
I think for me, it was a lot of heartache. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't all heartache, but a lot of what I remember, especially probably before I was 10, 11, was hard work.
Mm. 1979, he was born in Manchester. We're going to be vague with it, but we're going to, overview quite a lot of this, but someone in your life was very abusive towards you, a lot of violent abuse in early childhood, going right the way up. Was it daily?
Not daily, but, you know, it was the majority of the week. If we worked in week terms, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week.
What age did it start?
Probably around about, well, my brother was born when I was 6, so probably 4, 5.
Yeah. Okay. And what was it, slapping, punching? What was the actual extent of the...
A lot of it was emotional abuse, with some physical abuse, the odd slap around the head or punch in the head, you know, but emotional abuse was constant.
In what way?
Just bullying, belittling. It was just a real struggle. You know, my mum and dad divorced when I was a lot younger, so I'd had some form of separation anyway, and loss of family by moving around. So to not have that support when a person is, you know, emotionally abusing you is quite tough.
There was an incident that when we spoke that really shocked me, and that was, what was it called? Is it Snake Pass? Is that
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
It was, I was hung over the edge. I was asleep. And I was hung over the edge of Snake Pass as a very small child.
What is Snake Pass?
It's the, I think it's the A52 between Sheffield and Manchester.
She was hung over the road?
Yeah. It's got a massive, like, 90-foot drop, or probably bigger in some places.
I just found that really shocking because of my children are the same age as what you'd have been then. It's almost, like, even now thinking about having someone do that to them, I just can't... Do you ever... We'll get onto that later on, but it's really it's upsetting that was going on. And so you said a second ago your brother was born in 1985, so you'd have been 6.
Yeah.
Things changed then.
Yeah. it became quite difficult. I was kind of cast aside, or what I thought at that time, I was cast aside. And basically the emotional abuse remained pretty constant, but I think the physical abuse increased.
So that was one example a second ago, being hung over, but what, like punching?
Punching, like, I remember one time I'd been grounded for something. I don't know, you know, I don't ground my kids. But I'd been grounded at about 6 or 7, and I got released from being grounded. Went and did something. I think it was, I licked some icing off a cake and was sent back to my room, and it was like proper isolation. Being grounded to your room, not like grounded within the house, or, you know, not allowed to go on a computer. It was go in your room and spend time in there.
And I mean, even just from the outset, I mean, that can seem like a minor thing, really. As in, even the actual punishment of it, a minor thing. But actually, to a child who's had years and years of it, and who just wants to be, hopefully I'm not speaking for you, but just kind of loved and looked after and feel safe and secure, which every child should, you know, regardless of people around them. It can really play or really impact a child's mental well-being as well, and moving forward. And when your brother was born, 1986, you started looking after him a lot more. He was seven. He was one.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
So there was a lot of things going on in terms of the people within my life.
Yeah.
My mum was working a lot. So, you know, not that I took full responsibility for him, but, you know, I would change him, look after him, feed him. You know, it's probably normal what you know, a sibling or an older sibling would do. But I think when you live in a kind of toxic environment and, you know, your mum's under a lot of emotional distress, I think I kind of thought I need to kind of step in and help out. Not that she ever asked me to, but that's, you know.
Because your mum was out working so many different jobs and she was out the house a lot.
Yeah.
So what you'd be doing, like changing nappies and cooking food?
Well, I cook for myself and then do his bottle and do his food, but that kind of increased later on in life. It wasn't so much. I wasn't doing that much for him, you know, at that age. I think when he kind of grew up a little bit, I was doing a lot more.
So was you a young carer then, age seven? Would it be classed as that?
Yeah.
Because you was caring for...
I was, you know, when you define being a carer, you know, it's doing above and beyond what is expected you of your age. You know, it's not to say that you don't have chores or you can't look after your brother or feed him or whatever, but, you know, as a seven-year-old, you know, what would you expect a seven-year-old to do at that age? You know, for me, if they clean their room, great. That was the chore that they would do, my children. But to have a lot of emotional responsibility in terms of supporting, you know, my mum through what she went through, I think that was a huge impact on my, you know, growing up.
Just because it's a sensitive subject, and if you aren't, let's just say, because you know that carer thing and feeding and dressing and all this, if you, and I don't want to put your mum in a bad light either, because she was, you know, if you look at, you know, the Maslow's pyramid of needs, she was at the bottom, really surviving and really trying to do what's best for you, and I'm not taking that away from her. But if you hadn't have been there, would your brother have suffered? As in, like, from your day-to-day caring, if that's what...
Yeah.
Who would have done it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
The other people within our lives didn't have that ability because of their ongoing, you know, issues, mental health, alcohol. So it was, you know, my mum did a great job, but I think she was an emotional victim as well. Well, she was an emotional victim. So it's difficult, you know. Would things have changed, been different if I didn't do those little bits as a kid? Probably not, but.
What was a day-to-day life like then? Even like because we'll touch on it later on as well. But you know them early days of it. You know, being you 7, 8, and you have a 1 and a 2-year-old brother.
Yeah.
What was day or week to week like?
From what I remember, the majority of it, you know, it was all right when other people weren't around. You know, it was great. You know, there's three of us. It was great family. But. You know, when other people were around, it was quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of my memories was, you know, kind of taking my brother and going to hide in a bedroom, or, you know, trying to keep him quiet. So it's just proper walking on eggshells every day. It's trying to, you know, as a 7 or 8-year-old, trying to emotionally think, right, how can I not make something happen, you know, and that's...
How can I protect myself? How can I protect my brother?
Yeah.
I don't want to speak too much for you, but there's reasons why we can't go into certain things too much. Did it impact your childhood then in those early days?
Yeah.
Is there any positives or is it all negative to come?
There's a lot of positives, really. You know, I had a really good relationship with my mum. I think that kind of strengthened the way we are. You know, I had good schooling, you know, where we were at the time. You know, I made friends. And I remember when we was, you know, in Germany, we lived in some flats, and there was a caretaker who kind of understood what was going on, and he would say, come on, you come and help me and get some respite. And, you know, I used to go and help him do like handy jobs, and, you know, he used to make me sandwiches and all that kind of stuff. It was great. It was just, you know, a couple of hours of someone looking after you and, you know, taking care of, come on, let's go and do something. You don't need to be in there all the time.
Did you crave kind of attention of other people, or was you actively seeking kind of role models, or inadvertently seeking role models, or was you looking at other people's kind of situations?
No, I don't think. I think, you know, as an 8-year old, you don't really see the big picture. I think for me it was, you know, this is my life, this is normal, you know, so is everyone else, must be kind of going through the same thing.
Yeah. When did that? We'll obviously move quite a lot here, but did you ever have like a switch one day, years later, think, oh, actually, that was not normal? Or has it taken a long time for that kind of...
There was a switch. It was a pretty abrupt switch.
I know what you're going to say. We'll say that in a minute.
Yeah.
Because it's really... But there was a time when... Yeah, okay. Yeah. One thing or another, your mother's marriage ended in 1991-ish. She then, 92, met and remarried again. Mm-hmm. He's a good bloke.
Yeah, top lad.
Did you start feeling safe?
Yeah. I remember, you know, my granddad died in September, and I didn't want to go up to Manchester to the funeral. And I remember he took me and my mate to go and watch Barnet play. I'd only met him once. He was like, come on, you two, let's go. We're going to go and have, you know, burgers and watch Barnet. And it was nice. It was really nice to kind of see someone who you don't really know, but just is, you know, a nice male human, you know, when you haven't had that experience, really, to kind of go, come on, we'll go and do some lad stuff.
Yeah. Oh, what are you, about 12? Yeah.
Yeah.
92, 12, 13.
Yeah.
It is good. And that's the time I always think, like, when you're about probably 13, 14, that's when those role models around you and people you can look up to, you start kind of growing up, and really it makes you who you are, really. Later on. Was you still looking after your brother?
Yeah, I was probably looking after him from when we moved to London. I think I was 11, so I was just finishing. I did my last year in primary school before I went up to high school, and I was looking after him a lot. Basically, the things that were happening with other people within our lives, my mum was working 3-4 jobs, you know, and it was hell. It was really hell. And I would get my brother ready for school, not always take him, but sometimes take him on my way, and he was just with me all the time. Like, when I was growing up, going out with my mates, I had to take someone who was 6 years younger than me.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't, well, not that I didn't do anything, but it was tough having your little brother around. And I probably, you know, was a bit nasty to him at times. Yeah. And I think I resented him quite a lot for me having to look after him. You know, I probably bullied him more than I should have.
Yeah.
Thinking it was all his fault. But, you know, as an adult, you know, you can reflect on that and, you know, say, actually, it wasn't your fault. But at the time, it was constant. Couldn't go anywhere with him. I was cooking for him, getting him ready for school, getting him ready for bed.
Was there only three of you in the house then at this point? So there was your mum and
there
you
wasn't
two.
The three. Well, when it got to a point where there was the three of us.
Yeah. And that's when she was four jobs trying to put food on the table for you two.
Well, that was even before there was just the three of us because of, you know, the circumstances within at that time, you know, the other people within our lives weren't due to, you know, issues.
Yeah. So what was the day again? Like, what was the day in the life like? So you're 12, you're at senior school, your younger brother's a kid still, a little boy. You're waking up, and then what are you doing?
So
Monday morning.
So I'd get myself ready, help get my brother ready if my mum was at work, take him to breakfast, take him to school. I go to school, and like during school, it was horrible, you know, because you're always anxious, you know, about whether, you know, what's going on at home. You know, you can't concentrate and thinking, oh, I hope my brother's all right. And it's really difficult because, you know, not a lot of people kind of understand what it's like to live in a house or, you know, a home where there's a lot going on emotionally, physically. So it's tough, you know, and then you come home and it's like, right, didn't do my homework, never done homework. I didn't have time for homework. Excuse me, and you know, sort my brother out, see what my mum's doing, you know, sit and talk to my mum, you know. Then she'd go out back to work. She used to work in a pub, so she wasn't home till like 11 o'clock, half 11, 12. So I used to sit up and wait for her to make sure that she got home all right. Then I'd go to bed and it'd be start again.
Did it you think you've said it, so it affected your schoolwork?
Yeah, immensely. You know, went through high school, left as the sports captain. That was my achievement.
Yeah.
I got a C in music and art. That was it. Nothing else.
96 now. You joined the army. You joined the Royal Logistic Corps. Why did you join?
I wanted to play football as a kid. And it never happened. And my mum was like, just go get a job. So I got on the tube, went to Leicester Square. So I went to Charing Cross careers office, and that was it. Well, first time I went, I filled in all these forms. And they said, oh, you've got asthma or anything, wheezing. I was like, oh, I do wheeze a bit, because I used to have like panic attacks when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So he said, oh, you can't join. I was like, oh, God. And I was going to join the Remy. So I went back a week later. Filled in the forms.
No wheezing.
Cured. And then I said, oh, I need to get in as quickly as possible. I need to get away. I need to escape. And they said, right, we've got two jobs. You can either be a supply controller or a supply specialist. And I was like, what are they like? He said, one stacks the shelves and one orders them. I said, right, just sign me up. I'll do any. That was it. I was gone.
Yeah.
So I think it was a month turnaround.
You could have got a job at, I don't know,
Tesco's. Yeah.
Why did you join the army though? Because there's a difference. Your mum telling you go and get a job, which I understand. You know, low income family. You know, I had to go get a job as soon as I left. In between that and joining the army, you know, I was in Asda stacking shelves. Yeah. But I always wanted to join the army to almost get away and to make some of myself. But why did you join the army?
For me, it's a comfort blanket. Whenever. Even now, you know, and I know we're going to go into it in a bit, but even now when I get low, my wife's like, you're not going in the army. Because I grew up as a military child. So it's what I knew. I knew how the army worked. I knew, you know, what was expected of me. And it was easy. I didn't have to think.
Yeah.
So the military, I think it's a good place to go and get a grounding. And to be supported, you know, when you haven't been supported throughout your life, you know, it's a good grounding place. And like I say, it was a comfort blanket because I knew how it worked, so I didn't have to
It was easy. It was obvious to go join, get away from it all.
Get away and just join a conveyor belt for me of just tell me what to do. I don't have to think.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you, when you was away, did you still think, because it was a different situation as well, like with your mum and your brother, did you have still have responsibility for them? Or was it just like, my only responsibility now is me?
Yeah, because at the time, obviously my mum was, you know, in a really good place with the person that she was with. You know, he absolutely adored my brother. So it was just me, you know.
Yeah.
I went to Purbright and all I thought about was me.
Mm.
And, you know, my mum would send me, you know, like shoe boxes just full of crap, you know, boot polish and everything. And I used to sell it.
I mean, when you're looking after your brother and your mum, and then you're looking after yourself, it's you can, you know,
it's a luxury.
Raise up opportunities. And did you enjoy it? Time in, did 6 years.
Yeah, I did. I think, you know, I loved basic training, and phase two training was a bit of a wash, to be honest. But I went to a really good regiment, met some great people, some, you know, still in contact with now, and you know, go and see them. And then I kind of thought, you know, I'm ready for settling down. But kind of what made me leave was because of my childhood experience, I wanted to settle down out the army.
So we joined, you started almost thriving. She went to Bosnia and Kosovo as well.
Yeah.
6 years in, and because of the impact of your childhood, you saw what? Go on.
Well, I wanted a wife. Well, you know, I didn't just go out and just pick one off the street, like, you know, but I wanted a family, you know, and for me personally, I didn't want to raise a family in the military. I didn't want my kids moving around. I didn't want my wife to be alone for however long, because I've lived that experience, and not to say that my kids would go through exactly the same experience, but I found it tough, and I don't think I personally could have left them. You know, being in the military, I couldn't have left them and gone here, there and everywhere, because, you know, I didn't have the mental strength to do that. You know, so the army was great. It gave me, you know, it actually gave me some balls, basically, to stand up and be a man. But I wanted a family.
And your childhood, and I'm doing your story an injustice, and the first, you know, your childhood, and it was fucking horrible. And I want people to understand that. Because the next part is really important, and understand why that family was so important. And actually, you know, I've got friends, their kids are in, their kids thrive, they're loved, they're doing really, really well. For some families it works, and you'll know this, I'm preaching to the converted, and you know, more than me, you know. So, but it's understandable why you thought in that way.
Yeah.
You left in 2003. When did you meet your wife?
The 15th of November 2003.
When did you leave?
February.
You sure you didn't have this on mail order?
No, definitely not. I wish I did.
Yeah. You still with her now?
Yeah.
I'd have edited that out if not. Yeah. And what was that like then? What did that mean to you at that time? What was you doing when you left?
When I left, I spent 3 months at my mum's house, sitting in the living room, absolutely flat as anything. And I'd never, ever felt like that. The only time I recall feeling exactly the same was when I was grounded, being in that room on my own. It was so lonely, you know, because who wants to go back, you know, to your mum's when you're like 23?
Yeah.
You know, been an independent man for, you know, 6.5 years. So, you know, I got a job. I was lucky because my ex-girlfriend from when I was a kid, her uncle worked for the Met Police. So I went and worked for the Method of Entry team there, which was great. you know, just go around London smashing down doors for the police. But I think I struggled a lot with my mental health because it was, you know, a lot of shift work, and I'd never done shift work before.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was quite lonely. I think that was, isolation was huge. I felt so alone. And then in November I met Charlotte, and then that was it.
What do you mean your mental health? You had what, poor mental health?
Yeah, I had poor mental health. I think, you know, looking back now, I had depression. That's what it was.
Because of leaving or because of your childhood?
I think a lot of it was to do with my childhood because, you know, I've said to you before, I think the military gives you structure and discipline and routine, and that's what you prescribe to people with poor mental health. You know, so getting that structure, discipline and routine, you know, it supported my health. I didn't know that I had mental health I didn't have mental health problems before I joined the army. But I think the accumulation of kind of what I went through as a child, not processing it for 6 years because of the routine and structure, and then coming out to nothing, it gives you a lot of time to go, actually, you know, to decompress and
decompress,
say,
yeah.
I'm like, I'm a bit messed up in the head.
Well, what is depression?
You know, depression is different for everyone. You know, you can have depression and not function physically, or, you know, but for me, I was just so lethargic. You know, I didn't want to get dressed, didn't want to wash, didn't eat, you know. It was tough.
Mm. Is there on a kind of physical level, or with the brain, is this something that is different? Because is there a difference between being depressed and depression? Like, is this something that goes on chemically?
Yeah. It's a chemical imbalance within your head. So,
in what way?
Your serotonin levels aren't at a certain level to function, and that's why, you know, when you go running, you know, for me, with suffering from depression, if I go running, that balances my chemicals out, you know, and I don't need any medication, I sleep well, you know, so as long as I'm doing fizz, my brain chemicals are working.
I can't think of the word now, but one kind of affects the other. So if you're feeling lethargic, that affects you actually getting your trainers on and going out.
Yeah.
But if actually you just went, get my trainers on and go out.
And go,
but you physically can't do it.
Yeah.
Was you getting medication at this point?
No. It wasn't until later on. 9 years later, really.
But 9 years without any medication or therapy?
Yeah. Because at the time, I kind of didn't realise that I had depression. I just thought I was just a lonely, quiet lad who was quite insular. And then going up to 2010, I started my nurse training, mental health nurse training.
What was you doing before that then? Were you still employed by the Met?
No, I'd moved in 2005.
Yeah.
Moved up to the northeast, and right. I worked for Northumbria Police as a community support officer.
Right, okay.
Did 5 years there, and then got my education. I got my GCSEs, which I never got.
Oh, did you, when you was doing that?
Yeah. 2009, I got did an access course, so I could go and do my degree.
Why nursing? Why did you choose nursing?
The kids I was working with within the police had a lot of issues at home. They were on the streets, drinking, taking drugs. And I kind of worked with the youth offending team for a year. And, you know, I kind of look and say, you know, if you can stop someone getting to this point, where's that input? And I thought, right, nursing, mental health nursing. So I did my mental health degree in 2010.
Oh, is that what you did? So you went, so is that how it works then? So you don't just do so it's not a generic nursing degree?
No.
You went specific
straight in, yeah.
For mental health?
Yeah.
Nursing.
Yeah. And during that time, that's when I knew I had depression, during my nurse training.
Because you recognised it?
In a really abrupt way, I did. Because I was doing my nurse training, I was on placement, so that's like doing shifts within on a ward, and I was trying to join the TA, 201 Field Hospital, and I'd been away, and it was the weekend that Gary Speed died, and I went away. And our dog had just died as well that Friday. So I was a bit whether to go away for the weekend because my wife was, you know, in bits. And I was really tired. And I remember coming back. I'd had a tough placement before I went away for the weekend. And I'd come back and I was absolutely shattered. And I remember my wife just asked me a question and I just ripped her head off. And I was just like, and my mum was there as well, you know, and I'd never, ever done it before.
What, screamed over? Did you get violent?
Yeah, I didn't.
Threatening?
Yeah, threatened to knock her head off her shoulders if she didn't shut up. And then she just burst into tears, and my mum just went upstairs. She was crying, and I was just like, what?
Yeah.
What was that? You know, that's not me. And I went, my father-in-law took me to a Newcastle match after the Gary Speed, suicide. And the crowd were just like, obviously just clapping. And I just remember standing there crying, absolutely tears just rolling down my eyes. And I said, right, went to the doctors the next day. And I'd planned suicide.
What, before that? Yeah. Before the incident with your wife?
Leading up to that.
Was the training having a negative, the degree training, is that what you call it? Was that having a negative?
Well, I found it tough, you know, not having an education, not being able to write, or, you know, the way you meant to write. I was struggling with that. We had a few financial issues. I was struggling with that. And I think I was doing too much, you know, with placement, with, you know, trying to be in the TA. And yeah. I think that was one of the signs. Why would I want to be in the army? You know, again, that's a comfort blanket. If things are going wrong, I want to join back up. My wife laughs now and says, "Oh, you're too old now, so you can't do it anymore." But yeah, and I kind of got hold of a friend who probably, the phone call she made probably saved my life. She made a phone call to Talk in Two Minds. And within I think that was on the Friday, and by Monday I was in Manchester.
Why did it say, what do you mean it saved your life? How?
Because I'd planned everything. And
So the planning of the suicide started before threatening your wife, but then it went straight through?
Straight through, yeah.
So it was still there on your mind?
Yeah.
Is that why you cried at the football game?
Yeah.
Because you knew you were going to do it?
Yeah.
What did Talking to Minds do?
I don't know what they did, but the way that their service and their practitioners worked, it really, really just changed the way I was thinking. It was like being a third person in my own life, like watching it. It was like imaginary, kind of, it was NLP. So it was like looking at different situations within your life and looking objectively at it, as opposed to feeling it and, you know, seeing it as I was as a child. It was actually seeing it from above to look at everyone else's perspective. And it really kind of went, oh, actually, yeah. So that wasn't my fault. That wasn't my fault. That wasn't my fault.
Going right back to childhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it mainly childhood that it was affecting?
Yeah.
Your current mental health state was the childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you I'm just going off a bit here, but did you ever speak to your mum about it? On at the time or now?
Not at the time. I did speak to my mum, and I was a bit, because of the life we had, I used to not share my feelings with my mum a lot because I didn't want to add to her.
Yeah.
So it's like feeling transfer, and I didn't want that. But I remember after this NLP session,
what's NLP?
Neuro-linguistical programming.
Okay.
So after I'd had that, I kind of did the same thing with my mum because I was a bit scared of her reaction. So I was like, oh, my GP said this, we need to do this. So we kind of took turns in each other's roles.
Okay.
Of what it was felt like to be each other at that time. And then since then, you know, I've been able to kind of man up to my mum, really stand up to her, you know, and not say, actually, I'm going to take everything.
Mm.
I'm going to say, actually, no, that's yours. That's not mine. You know, and I think that's kind of helped. But, you know, I still do suffer with depression, even now. But it's, you know, I've got a great GP, got a great family, and I can, you know, like we spoke about, you know, previously and in other podcasts, I can understand the symptoms. I know the symptoms. I know the knowledge of the symptoms, and I actually do something.
What would be a symptom? Let's say tomorrow, would it trigger in a day, in a night? Would you wake up like it? Does it take weeks to come on?
Yeah, so basically, you know, a lot of the time, six months ago, I went back to my PhD. So I took 6 months off my PhD because my mental health was quite bad. And I would function. I'd get up, sort the kids out, and as soon as the house was empty, I was back to bed. You know, just the day was just drifting by, and then I'd get up, get the kids, and then function again. You know, I was so lethargic. And then I got a job just nursing, and I think that kind of helped because I was interacting with people. And then, you know, I'd go and see the doctor, get some meds, and then go from there.
Do you ever get suicidal again to that point? You never got down to there again?
No, you know, there's fleeting thoughts of suicide. You know, that's part of my depression. But it's not not something that I'd act on or do anything about. Mm. I've got a woods at the back of my house, and, you know, I take the dogs up there all the time, and you think, oh, I could hang from this tree. But it's not. It's a fleeting thought. It's not anything pertinent that's going to stay there.
Yeah, it's not, what's the word, like a logical planned approach or anything like that.
No.
2013, did you qualify as a psychiatric nurse then? Or did you start training?
Yeah, I finished, I got my degree and I stayed on at university, but I went to Teesside University to do my specialist community public health course in school nursing. Which was probably the hardest thing I've ever done. And I'm teaching it now, but it is so hard. It's pretty much a master's in 9 months, as well as practicing as a nurse.
Okay.
It's hard, really hard.
How was that all right then to deal with?
I think over around Christmas time, it was a bit tough because a lot of the assignments were due in, and I was traveling, you know, 2 hours to Middlesbrough and back every day. So it was tough. And I probably did have a few breakdowns, mini breakdowns, but, you know, the uni supported me really well, and I just got on with it and got through it. Mm. And then I got my dream job in Catrick. So I was the school nurse for the garrison.
What did that entail? Normal nursing, or was it more psychiatric?
No, it was the specialist school nursing. So that's an additional qualification to my nursing degree.
Sorry, go on.
So that looks at like the public health of like children. So it's like the early intervention and looking at the bigger picture of child health.
And why was the dream job Catrick Garrison?
I think because I wanted to raise the awareness of military children and kind of, you know, the positive things that they go through, as well as the negative that some may go through. You know, it's a small proportion of military children who go through negative, who have a negative experience. You know, but it's trying to give them a voice with that. I was invited down to Westminster, the Department of Health, to kind of champion that point, because there's no health policy for military children. So, you know, the school nursing and health visitors, national leads really got into it and developed the school nurse and health visitor pathway for military families. So that was the first kind of health policy or pathway for military children and their families.
So what does that mean practically then? Is there any practical benefit of that?
Yeah, so basically it's a pathway of how to support military children and families with a number of issues, because of, you know, I'm not saying that military children are any different to any other children, but I think it's a cultural difference which has to be recognised.
Mm.
And that's the impact the military has on military families. It's that cultural difference to civilian difference, you know, to being a civilian, sorry. So it's kind of just those small nuances of saying, yeah, they might have the same thing as someone in Civvy Street, but because of X, Y, and Z factors, this might be impacting. I remember, you know, in Catrick, I worked with a child who was 6. She'd moved 5 times, and wondering why, the parents were wondering why she was, you know, disruptive and unsettled. And,
yeah,
you know, so it's just them tiny little things, you know, that you have to kind of champion.
Well, what are the biggest issues? Because obviously we've had Louise Fettigan on who founded Little Troopers, and that almost deals with the consequence. It's funny now, we've got you, we'll go on to it in a second, more about your PhD, is actually dealing with the problem, if that makes sense, instead of what are the problems faced with service children specifically? Or what can they face?
So, yeah, it's more what can they face, but I think it's, you know, a parent or both parents being away quite often. You know, you can be securing like home life but struggling school. So depending on the environment, you know, there's different vulnerabilities, and it's about where we can kind of support military children and young people that way. You know, I think anxiety is probably one of the biggest issues, especially during, you know, the conflicts that we've, you know, recently had, that would significantly impact on a child. You know, my mum, my dad's away, you know, actually fighting. They're not, you know, on training anymore.
Mm.
You know, that actually there is a potential.
What age group are we looking at then for like actually realising that that's going on?
I think, you know, it depends on the child. I think we can say, you know, as soon as 8, 9, 10 year olds are saying, you know, I'm a bit worried about my dad, but you know, it's about behavioural change. When we notice in a child that the behaviours are changing, you know, we have to ask why.
Mm.
So if you know, they're usually, you know, really good at school and, you know, happy go lucky, and then, you know, mum or dad's been away for a couple of weeks now, and then the behaviours have started to change, you know, they're becoming disruptive, they're upset, you know, they're starting to wet themselves, you know, it's just things like that, you know, that we have to be kind of aware of.
Mm.
Just kind of look at, you know, the physical response to, you know, the emotional issues that are going on.
So we shouldn't, because quite often we can just go, oh, it's because of that.
Yeah.
His dad's away, or her dad's away, so it's because of that. So what should people be doing if they go, you know, there is a behaviour change? Dad's away in Canada, dad's away in wherever, mum's away wherever. What should we be doing if you see a change in behaviour?
I think it's about kind of supporting the child and getting the parent that is at home, you know, into school or into your GP and saying, you know, I've seen this change, you know, mum or dad's been away, you know, can we have some support? You know, and schools are doing amazing things for military children in kind of putting a whole wraparound system around them just for short periods of time, not like longevity, but just to kind of manage through child crisis.
Yeah.
And then supporting the other end. And I think that's kind of, you know, what is needed. It's that, right, we just wrap around you for this short period of crisis to give you some security and help you develop and build some, you know, growth and resilience within yourself and security, your emotional security, and then just leave them to get on. It's not a case of, you know, you need support for however many months. It might be a couple of weeks. You know, children are so robust. You know, you might not need a whole, you know, social services or anything like that. It might just be one person can go, come on, I'll hold your hand through this.
Well, like a football coach or a teacher, anyone, or a relative.
Yeah.
Just a bit of additional support.
Yeah.
Your background, your childhood, is that giving you more understanding and empathy and more, not credibility, but more drive maybe to make what you're doing now happen? Like, can you function better doing your job now because of your background?
Yeah, absolutely. With regards to my PhD, is in young carers of veterans with mental health problems. You know, I've lived that. So, you know, this is full circle. This is trying to raise, you know, awareness that we have been in, you know, long conflicts, and there is, you know, an increase in, you know, military and veteran mental health. So if there's an increase in that, then is there an increase in, you know, children and young people providing some form of care? Absolutely, there has to be.
Ah, right. Okay. So what is because the impact that, let's say, conflict has had on the parent, and let's say, for example, it's Iraq or Afghanistan, we're now looking at the impact it's having on the children and how they're caring for siblings.
Or their parent who's got a mental health problem.
Ah, right, okay. So what is the research you're doing? Go on.
That is the research.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically I'm speaking to, so I'm doing qualitative research. So it's listening to the stories of children who are caring for the veteran with mental health problems.
Is it growing? Is the problem growing? Has it always been there, but we haven't recognised it?
It's always been there. Wherever you have a child, they will be doing some form of care.
Can you give, without being specific to a child, being like general, like a make-believe answer, as you would, like, what are the children facing? Because everything's different. It's not always like yours, for example, where there was an abusive problem, but what, let's say there's someone with PTSD or...
Yeah.
A mental health issue because of PTSD.
Yeah. So I've just done, because my research is anonymous anyway, so I have just done an interview with a young carer, and their step parent was in Afghanistan, seen someone get shot, came back, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, physical and emotional abuse. It was kind of like listening to my own story, if I'm honest. It was tough. It was tough for me, kind of listening to it. And then I've had to transcribe it. So I've had to keep listening to it.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a struggle. But I think, you know, what we're seeing anecdotally is, you know, kids are, you know, providing emotional support. They are, you know, walking on eggshells. They're prompting for medication. You know, they're supporting parents going to different kind of organisations.
What do you mean prompting? Sorry, mate, prompting for medication, what do you mean?
So,
That you're telling the parent?
Telling the parent.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Like, you've got to take your tablets.
Yeah, and,
They're doing paperwork for them, you know, filling in forms for, you know, different, you know, benefits and, you know, and these are, you know, kids.
How old? What? Sorry, I'm being really vague, but I'm just trying to get some... Because if someone, you know this is why we're having this conversation, but if someone can recognise this.
Yeah.
So is it 6-year-olds doing this? Is it 15-year-olds doing
it? It's the full spectrum. When I was school nursing, I supported a young carer who was 6, who was prompting parents to do their medication. You know, and the young carer that I've just had an interview is, they're 14. You know, so it is the full spectrum.
The conversation you were just talking about a second ago.
Yeah.
Well, what do you do after that then? What do you do with that information? Does that just go into your research, or does it get used? Can you impact that person, or is it just totally anonymous?
It's totally anonymous.
Yeah.
So it is part of my research, but as part of my PhD, I have to release papers as I'm research papers. So that story, because it's my first one, will be published.
As a white paper kind of thing? Is that...
No, just as a research article, basically. But, you know, we are looking at how we support the voice of children within the military and the veteran sector. So their voices are heard. So it's not just about figures. Mm. It's about their narrative and their story.
What is the long-term goal for this then? Your goal? You're the only one in the world doing it? The PhD on it? Pick yourself up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's been a journey. I've kind of made some really good connections in the US with Texas University. They're going to supply me with some young carers in the US because it's not even being done there either.
Mm.
So yeah, this is the first one looking at the young carers within the veteran community.
And then what will happen in, what's the hope of that? The research is one thing, and then the action, what's the action are you hoping going to be? Just a more of an understanding?
As leaders within young carers, we are the leaders in the UK about young carers, you know, it was, you know...
The military?
No, just young carers in general. Right, we are leading in the world. But we are aware of them. And I think it's the language that has to change. It's not, we've been aware of them since, you know, year blog. We have to actually do something and support them if they want it. You know, not all young carers want support. Yeah. But if they do, we have to have the infrastructure to do that. So like I say, you know, if previously it's about understanding a culture of young carers. It's not about understanding young carers generally, but we have to do that. But within the military, you know, there's a different cultural set, and especially with the transition from the military and some people struggling with that, then, you know, we have to understand the transition and the mental health that comes with, you know, a veteran. Obviously not all veterans, but some veterans, and the impact that has on their family and their children.
Hopefully this conversation will go on and on, you know, on whatever platform. But right now you're doing, obviously, this research, and how can people get involved with that?
So on my Twitter handle, I've got my...
What's that? What's your Twitter handle?
Mr. Paul Watson.
Okay, I'll stick it on as well.
Yeah, champion. So it's just an advert I've pinned at the top of my Twitter page. So everything's there. What I want of you, and basically my contact details.
And what is it? Is it specifically for carers now, or kids now, or is
kids now? So between 11 and 18 year olds
who are caring for
caring for a veteran with mental health problems.
Right, okay. We've just glossed over everything. Hopefully it gives again an overview, and we could have, like many of these conversations, we could have gone into everything at great length and spent 7 or 8 hours here talking. Is there anything else you want to add? Things that something we've missed or
no,
it's fine. No, I think we're good. Yeah, we're good. I just didn't want
to. Yeah.
The opportunity's there. Paul, thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate it. I hope this goes on and does some great stuff. Again, I'll put all the Twitter stuff out and websites. Brilliant. And everything else we need. We'll leave it there.